going. I'm going to go check the drawings, and I'm going to get you a bottle of water.
Yeah, I need that. All right.
It was closed upstairs.
That's okay, good. All right.
Everyone's pinned up, right? I'm going to go check.
Everyone's not pinned up is not pinned up, so... Okay, this is Monte. This is Monte. So you've got the thing for next week, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right. I just got to find my Sibylus. Okay. I got that. Okay, we're going to do two architects today, Brunelleschi and Alberti. Next week, you will be drawing the elements of the facade of San Andrea and their relationship to the interior facade. So that's an important exercise, and we'll talk about Alberti later. The importance of Brunelleschi is as follows. Number one, he is the first architect to be consciously recognized, let's say, after Vitruvius in northern Italy, number one. Number two, he's the first architect who understood that there was a epistemic shift happening in culture and life. That is, from a theocentric conception of the universe to an anthropocentric. That is, from a condition where God mediated between man and nature to a condition where man mediated between nature and God, that man was then the centric, anthropocentric condition. It is a shift from a transcendental metaphysic to an immanent one. That is, a metaphysic that is arbitrated from some supreme being or power to a metaphysic within the relationship of man, nature, the subject, etc. Brunelleschi, realizing this, that architecture had no discourse, had no capacity to make that relationship palpable, understandable, as architecture always was. Architecture was like the liturgy in the churches, in that it explained through drawing, sculpture, and other artifacts the relationship of man to God. Now, we were talking about the relationship of man to the architecture and to other human beings. So, Brunelleschi looked to other disciplines which had been formed in the sciences and mathematics, and found a condition perspective that already existed to be able to bring the object into a relationship to the subject. Prior to that, churches were designed merely in relationship to the liturgy in terms of what was structurally possible. No longer was structure the thematic, that is, the dominant discourse of Brunelleschi. The dominant discourse of Brunelleschi was the relationship between the individual and the object, the subject and object. So the first time that if you have perspective, you have a monocular view, that is the human being, you have a picture plane coming from the picture plane that evolved from Renaissance painting, and you have a condition whereby the projection from in depth is not merely literal depth, but depth that is organized so that the subject begins to see not only the real depth, but an idea of depth. Now remember, we talked about the idea, and we will when we get to Alberti, that this immanent metaphysic meant that the object not only was the literal object, but contained an idea of itself. I'm putting them in sequence, but that idea works with both Brunelleschi and Alberti. They follow each other in time, but the same idea that the object contains an idea which is made apparent to the subject through a perspectival monocular vision. So that when you go into San Lorenzo, for example, you see literal depth, the actual depth of the church, but also you see conceptual depth that is registered in the mind as something conscious, that what you're seeing is not only the depth but an idea of depth. Where conversely, in Santo Spirito, because of the organization perspectivally of the space, you're not only seeing the literal depth, you're seeing an idea of compression. And this is the difference between these two churches, and that's what it means to be able to see. In other words, what I'm going to be trying to open your eyes to is that when you are literally in San Lorenzo, you see depth plus an idea of depth. When you're in Santo Spirito, you see depth plus an idea of shallowness or compression against a picture plane. So while these churches have the same structure, the same idea of the liturgy, they function in the same way, they function differently in architecture. That is, the architecture is consciously different. And it's the first time in Santo Spirito what makes it an important building in architecture is there is an idea of implied compression. And this is what you find that architecture can do. It can have literal space and implied depth, or it can have literal space and implied shallowness. It will always have literal space. The question is how that literal space is modulated. So architecture is about the implied modulation of something that is literal. Architecture, therefore, also has been, since the instantiation of perspective by Brunelleschi, has also been a dialectical condition between the subject and object mediated through the optical. And one of the issues that I said stands for as a problem for architecture today is the notion that opticality, which was made thematic by Brunelleschi to bring about this notion of an epistemic shift, that opticality may not any longer be necessarily thematic. And as we roll through time and through architects and history, we're going to begin to see how this idea of opticality changes and modulates to the very present that we're in now. So we're not looking at Gothic style shift to Renaissance. We're looking at conceptual shifts that affect how you see, why you see, and the relationship of what you see to the experience that you have of the particular church. What I'm trying to also show you is that the function is the same, the structure is the same, the conception, that is the architectural idea, is different, so that the architectural idea begins to be independent of the function and begins to be independent of the structure. Now, sometimes thematically they're the same, sometimes thematically they're one or two are different, and we're going to begin to see how these differences play out. So Brunelleschi is the first person to bring about the relationship, articulated, thematized relationship between a subject. The first time the subject is articulated in architecture is in Brunelleschi. Now, therefore, we assume this relationship between subject and object, this dialectical relationship, is a natural one because it's been in place for 500 years. What I'm trying to show you that's very important in this moment is that it's a convention that prior to that time the subject-object relationship was not articulated. So what we have to look at, if in fact the question of dialectics, the question of the metaphysical dialectic, the question of the metaphysics of presence, the question of opticality are issues in contemporary thought, in literature, in philosophy, in science, in art, perhaps they are issues today in architecture. That's to be put aside. Okay, so what happens is that Brunelleschi begins to articulate a new idea of space and time. Now, when we get to Alberti, and I'm going to talk about Alberti theoretically before we look at the pictures, Alberti is the first person that writes consciously, understanding Brunelleschi, writes about painting and sculpture, and architecture, excuse me. He writes two books, Della Pittura, on painting, and De Re Edificatoria, on architecture. And in the book on painting, he suggests that the most important thing for an art is to have what he calls a storia, a history, which means a consciousness in time of its being, that a painter must understand and project into a work its storia. And so for the first time again, we have now a consciousness of the subject, and we need to develop, as mathematics and science did, this kind of historical consciousness. And this is an important idea for Alberti. The second book, which is on architecture, is actually 10 books. It's modeled on Vitruvius's 10 books of architecture, which was published in the first century of the Roman Empire. And this is now 1,500 years later. That Alberti writes a book, what you would call a categorical treatise, that is, a site, structure, enclosure, function, are all articulated in this form, which became the form for treatise and theory writing up through the 19th century, that is, as a categorical treatise. Now, the important thing about Alberti's 10 books, they are a critique of Vitruvius, basically. And what the important thing that Vitruvius said, he spoke about commodity, firmness, and delight. Those were the three issues: venustas, delight; firmitas, was firmness or structure; and commoditas was sort of functionality. Okay? If we get to the term firmitas, which means structure, what Alberti says is that Vitruvius didn't mean that buildings should stand up, because all buildings stand up, but that buildings should not only stand up, but look like they stand up. The idea of look like, that is, represent standing up, causes architectural language and architectural signs and architectural representations to be different than most other sign systems. Because if a column is to look like a column, then the sign and the object are one and the same thing. Whereas the sign in most language systems refer outward, and of course columns refer outward to trees, to human beings, etc., they also must refer inward to themselves. And this reference in and out makes of the architectural sign unique, and the architectural idea of representation unique. And this is an issue that when we talk about architectural language and representation, which is going to dominate any architect's thought. The first thing that anybody asks you when you're on a jury is not only how does it function, but what does it mean? Why does it look like the way it does? And the question of the look like is the one of the key questions that separates language from an architectural language. And so not only did Alberti suggest that we need a history, but we need an idea about communication, about representation. And we will be talking as we go through the semester about sign systems that go according to Charles Sanders Peirce, P-E-I-R-C-E, the first American pragmatist, categorization of signs as icons, symbols, and indices. And sometimes columns are icons, sometimes they are symbols, and sometimes they are indices. And we will begin to assess the different kinds of sign values that is possible for a column or a wall to be. Now, what Alberti does to organize this issue, he builds a building, a palazzo in Florence called the Palazzo Rucellai, which has a double system. It has a solid facade, and we'll look at it later, a solid facade which in fact has a columnation, a column and beam structure set into it, so that when you look at the Palazzo Rucellai, you see two structures, a wall-bearing structure and a columnar post and beam structure. Now, what you know is that it only takes one structure to hold a building up. If that's the case, if it's a wall-bearing building, What is the columnar structure doing? It is the sign of structure. And if it is a columnar post and beam building, what are the stones in the wall doing? They are the sign of the functioning of stones as wall bearing. So that he articulates in a building's facade the principle of look like. In other words, he not only writes about it, he then demonstrates it. Now, fast forward to today. We have shifted from what is called the mechanical paradigm to the electronic paradigm. And that means that when in the mechanical paradigm, we used to have to demonstrate and represent how forces, that is the force of gravity, was withstood by a column, a wall, some structural form. Since we are moved from the mechanical paradigm to the electronic paradigm, from forces of gravity, which are simple forces working this way, to electronic forces which work this way, in other words, not on the y-axis but on the x-axis, this says that we can thematize structure in a different way. And therefore, we no longer have to look like we are resisting gravity necessarily, but perhaps look like we are resisting or dealing with the horizontal forces, the vectors of the electronic media, i.e., the digital. Now, any of you that know Maya and Rhino know that you can throw a ball at a surface that has a certain density, a certain volume, size, and a certain velocity, and cause that surface to deflect according to the magnitude of the size, density, velocity. So therefore, we know that the electronic manipulation of surfaces and volumes cause different ideas to be in place. And therefore, we are no longer just dealing with axes, that is, the axis of the human being in a space. I am on the central axis of this space. There are two parallel side aisles so that you know when you're walking down here and you go back out that this is a symmetrical building. We are now, and these are inert, we're now dealing with the idea of vectors. And a vector is a line that has direction, it has amplitude, and it has speed. So what I'm suggesting is that you have to go back in history to understand where and how these issues, these thematic issues of axes, of resisting forces, of looking like, came into being before you can do something today that thematizes the issues involved in making architecture today. To thematize vectors is the same idea as thematizing the resistance to gravity. How does a building look like it is resisting gravity, and how does it look like it's resisting vectoral forces, lateral forces? And so that causes buildings to look like differently. And that's where your work comes in. What does the look like differently mean? Not for difference for its own sake, stylistic difference, but for a conceptual difference. Once you get that idea, what it has meant in the past to record conceptual differences in artifacts, that tell you about the space and time of the culture of its time, then you will understand what it means to do that today in architecture. To me, that is the great excitement, the challenge, and to record what is today for the history of tomorrow. And if you understand the things, that's why we go back to Brunelleschi and Alberti, and we build up a vocabulary of look-likes and understand what the theoretical issues were, we begin to understand what the discipline of architecture is. So what I'm trying to do is lay down foundation stones for you so that it's clearly understood what is meant by architecture. Now, the second thing that Alberti does, or the third thing, I mean, this is a very interesting guy. So we first have history, the second representation, that looking like structure, and the third thing is another form of representation. Alberti worked for the Duke of Mantua, Ludovico Gonzaga. And I will paraphrase a series of letters between Ludovico Gonzaga and Alberti. Ludovico noticed that not many people in Mantua were going to church. And he wrote a letter to Alberti and he said, "Look, Leone, we got to do something about church design. People don't seem to care anymore. We got to change church design." He said, "Give me a new idea that talks about the relationship of the church in the secular moment of anthropocentrism. In other words, how does the church exist in the anthropocentric moment? How does it exist in an immanent metaphysic as opposed to a transcendental one, where God mediated the aesthetic, the iconography, etc.? I need an iconography mediated by man." Alberti produces the facade of San Andrea at Mantua. It is the first facade that represents the secularity, as it were, and also the iconography of an immanent metaphysic. It also brings to bear a strategy of putting things together, which came to be known 4 centuries later as collage. He takes two different instances of architecture. One is the Greek temple facade, which had become a vernacular idea. That is, the pediment and columns was no longer seen as a pagan, which it was, icon, but now an icon of a vernacular style. So that when you saw a Greek temple facade, you saw something that was no longer seen to be pagan, no longer necessarily seen to be Greek, and had lost those meanings. And therefore, it had shifted from an icon of a Greek society, let's say, and will return to its iconic status, to a symbol, a vernacular symbol. That is, an agreed upon idea of a vernacular religious building. So he takes the Greek temple front and he collages onto it the symbol of man's domination over man, the Arch of Titus, erected in Rome in 66 AD to commemorate the destruction of the Second Temple. In other words, the subjugation of a people to the Romans. And the notion of the triumphal arch becomes also a symbol which you see repeated in many cities, the Arc de Triomphe in Paris, the Brandenburg Gate in Berlin, as emblematic of the cities in which they are. He takes the Arch of Titus, and he takes the Greek temple front, and he puts them together to make a new idea of a church facade. Now, what you're going to do next week is to see how does that relate to the interior. Now, what you have to do, clearly, to understand what's interesting about the interior in relationship to the facade, is you have to look at San Lorenzo and Santo Spirito and see, is there a difference that Alberti is trying to suggest between what he does on his facade and what he does in the side chapels and what Brunelleschi did. And I think there is a radical difference. And what I ask you to do is to find out what that radical difference is and to articulate it in drawing. In other words, to begin to see differences as they appear. In other words, we show you the cheese, you're the mouse that has to grab it without getting caught in a trap. Okay? I will always point out the cheese, and you got to be able to learn the difference between the cheese and the trap. That's very important. So, next week, we're going to look at what is, in your drawing, the relationship between the outside of the San Andrea and the interior. And it is the first time, I will just give you a clue, that there is a dialectical relationship between inside and outside in a building, which reappears again in modern architecture in the 1920s and the 1930s. Okay? So these things, these strategies for articulation and meaning, that is, and representation, are constantly reappearing. And, you know, if somebody says, oh, the modern movement is about the transparency between inside and outside, the term transparency becomes very important in Siegfried Gideon's work and the work of Colin Rowe and others, you can say, oh, well, you know, Alberti did it first at San Andrea. You have to do that with a slight condescending accent. But anyway, if I can give you that capacity, you might survive in architecture. Thank you. Before I go forward into the picks, are there any questions? I'd like to think that what I said this morning, first of all, is clear. It's like a fastball aimed at your head. Okay? And I want to see if you ducked, right? And you got the idea, something's coming at me, right? I can't tell because of the heat in this room, whether your sort of soporific being means that, oh, well, what does this matter to me, right? I get the sense from this audience here that you all remind me, at least, there's a famous Walt Whitman in a cartoon of Walt Whitman trying to encourage the American eagle to fly, and Walt Whitman is flapping his arms in this famous cartoon, and the American eagle is sitting on the ground with its wings like this, looking at Walt Whitman, saying, "What's this guy, crazy?" And I have a certain sense that I'm being a little like Walt Whitman here today, looking at you all, because, you know, the kind of reaction that I'm getting, and that's why I like to see your faces, is sort of, what's he talking about? Do you have any in your lethargy questions? Yes?
At the time this was happening, these churches were being built, Was there enough consciousness of what was happening at the church, or was there anybody recognized what Bruno Meschi was sounding like Alberti was doing as a move towards secularism?
I believe so. I believe these ideas wouldn't have survived historically if there wasn't a conscious recording. Don't forget that many people recorded, Vasari recorded the lives of architects, the writings continued to evolve, and the fact that these buildings have been maintained in history tells us that there was a consciousness. I mean, where do we get to the ideas in Bruno in Bramante of the corner? I mean, you know, don't forget there. I mean, we haven't started on all of the nuances of architecture, but how does a wall here hit a wall here, both on the outside and on the inside, right? And you say, oh yeah. Well, how it does that tells you something about the idea of the space, the relation of the space to the wall, the space to is the structure, etc. So there are many ideas that were going to come up, let's say, in the consciousness of Bramante, who follows from these two architects, a different consciousness, all right? Now that consciousness, and look, whether the guy on the street wandering around knows that or not is unimportant. It's whether the philosophers, the scientists, the people of culture understood these things, right? And it's clear when we see Bramante that he did, and others. They had patrons, right? The Duke of Mantua didn't write to Alberti because he was a dummy. He knew culturally what Alberti had written, the two books he had written. He knew other works of Alberti. He knew he was the person to deal with this subject. He was dealing with representation. Duca Mantua was a very powerful guy, right? All of these patrons that built these buildings, and Bramante had they became popes. I mean, they moved from dukes and local landlords all the way up to the church, the hierarchy of the church. And then, of course, it all changes with the French Revolution. But, you know, what the patronage is. There's no question there was a consciousness at the time of those people who could know. Don't forget, because there were no internet, there was no Google, etc. There was a consciousness on the people who could know, who had the power and the wealth to commission the architecture, that these issues were important. Yes.
I'm just curious. Before Brunelleschi inaugurates this idea of the interaction between the subject and the object, how does the role of supply sculpture figure in? Because that, to me, seems like it would be interaction.
It was the sculpture was the. It wasn't in the art. Remember, I showed you last week, and the reason why I started there, the architecture. It's proto architecture, proto idea. Of perspective. In other words, trying to correct painting and sculpture with actual perception. They're trying to get it right, right? And they're trying to use architecture, because all of the great paintings, I believe that Brunelleschi and Alberti and Bramante get their ideas from painters. I mean, Bramante worked with Piero della Francesca. These guys were not trained as architects. So the proto, when I show the baldacchini coming out into and in framing the figure, it's important because it's architecture that will begin to inframe the idea of architecture, not literally inframing, but conceptually inframing the subject. And so it begins in the wall sculpture, in the wall boards, in the murals, etc., of the churches.
But not within the within the sculpture itself, but between the visitor and the church, when they read it and they...
No, well, the visitor is supposed to be communicating with... The mediation is not with the sculpture, but with God. The sculpture is what we call the transcendental mediator, right? And everything was through the will of God. laid out in divine proportions, divine relationships, and the subject matter is the articulation of the liturgy, which most of the people couldn't understand. Speaking of understanding, the liturgy was in Latin, and most people didn't understand it. So the only understanding they had of this relationship was through the artifacts, not through the church. And gradually, the artifacts became less important as the vehicles of the church itself, the facture of the building became more important, as the subject became important, because the church is only God's instantiation in the presence of the subject. But the subject is not conceptualized in Gothic architecture, okay? The subject only begins to be conceptualized in early Renaissance painting, where the perspectival view comes in, right? And the figures move from illustrative figures to real representations of real differences in the apostles and virgins, and etc. All right. So there's a whole conceptual difference as we move from painting and sculpture through to architecture that takes place, which is a clear understanding that no longer could the world be conceptualized as flat. That science now had reached a point where they began to articulate other theories of evolution of the world, you know, and understanding of the universe. Copernicus, Galileo, I mean. And so the architecture really followed behind painting, as I believe it always does, because it's much easier and quicker to articulate an idea in a painting or a sculpture than it is in a building. And so you usually find the ideas. There's no question that Bramante's ideas come from Piero della Francesca. There's no question that he goes to Urbino and sees the courtyard of the Ducal Palace at Urbino, sees the corner at the Pazzi Chapel by Brunelleschi, and begins to articulate another idea of corner that has to do with his particular theoretical thematic that evolves out of Brunelleschi and Alberti. Yes?
Is there a record of how these decisions on a church like San Andrea, the vernacular architecture, actually impacted the original objectives of building a church like this when Duke requested it to begin with?
Well, I think the question you're asking is a sociological one, an anthropological one. I'm certain those records, I mean, the letters exist. Scholars have researched these kinds of things. I don't think it's necessary for a student in this class to know what that impact is. I don't think you need to do a survey of students that have been at Yale to understand why Rudolph's building is on a stamp. Right? You may hate this building, but it's irrelevant to this building's being. I hate this space with a passion to lecture in, right? But it's still, and we're not going to go into why is it considered a great building, and I think it is a great building, as the Kahn buildings, you know, there are certain buildings that are considered great buildings, because for its time, it took enormous risks. It presented things in a way, but it's not important that if we do a survey of what you think about it and collect all the surveys, it isn't going to change this artifact. Okay, so I don't think it's important to ever talk. Look, do we know about Borromini's churches in Rome, which were radical departures from the existing idea of a Roman wall church at the time? Do we know if his client was a fascist? Do we know if he stole money? Do we know if it leaked? Do we know if people could take communion there? It's unimportant in the history of what you're concerned with, whether those things did or did not happen. I am certain those records abound, right? I'm certain one of the reasons why Borromini killed himself was that his architecture was too radical. People said, hey, we don't really like this stuff, right? His clients, the Pope, said, hey, this is not the direction we want to go in. He didn't get very many commissions, and he killed himself. So there was clearly, but I don't think it's important for an architecture student to investigate as a thesis why Borromini killed himself. I think it's more interesting is what he did and why he did it at the moment in time, in terms of the relationship to the Counter-Reformation and other things, the needs that the church had to modulate space and time, and the relationship of the communicant to the mass was different, all right? Very different than in Brunelleschi and Alberti's time, even different in Palladio's time. So you have this movement in time. But if you're here to find out the socio-political reasons for those changes, you're in the wrong class, because that's what an architect needs to do. You need to be conscious that there is a difference, but you've got to be able to make that difference, right? Not understand the reasons for it, because if you can understand the reasons and can't make the difference today, then you're not an architect. You're a sociologist. And I very want to be clear about that. Yes?
Can you talk a little bit more about the change in emphasis from architecture dealing with vertical forces to the lateral?
We will get there later. Look, when you draw a line with a T-square and a triangle and a rapidograph pen, we used to use these Pelican pens when I was in school, which you had to, where they were scissor pens, and you'd have to fill them up and then screw the thing down and make sure the line was, we didn't have 0.01 rapidographs and things like that, which the ink comes out the same all the time. We had to wipe the pen clean and everything. So we were dealing with troglodytic equipment, right? You could draw a straight line, and maybe with one of those things, I forget what they call it. What?
French curve.
You could draw. We used to have little plastic ones, and they got the rubber ones later. But then you need to draw on the rubber one, and the ink would blot underneath. So to make something other than Cartesian space, that is X, Y, and Z space, all you did was make columns. Here was the floor. Here were the columns. Here was the roof. With a computer, you can make all kinds of things that are no longer X, Y, Z coordinates. There's new kinds of geometry. There's Riemannian geometry. There's topological geometry. There's fractal geometry. There are all kinds of new issues in geometry. When I studied geometry, we had a course called descriptive geometry, where all we did was cast shades and shadows on solids, Platonic solids. Today, anybody doing that, you know, is seen to be out of touch with what the tools and equipment that you have allow you to do. What I only want to do is to say this, that we used to have, Corbu had a book on nature by Darcy Thompson. A huge volume, The Forms of Nature. And nature was one of the representational possibilities for architecture, making things look that they came from nature, okay? Natural forms. And the kinds of proportional systems that Corbu developed came out of natural forms and forms he saw in nature, spirals and snail-like forms, etc. Pythagorean numbers and what have you, right? What science has allowed us to see is the forms in nature that we understand sometimes have other than pure mathematical equivalence in space and time, let's say. For example, chaos theory has shown us that landslides and tsunami and earthquakes and other things, volcanic eruptions, have very complex structures that we labeled chaos before, but they're no longer, into a scientific mind, understood to be chaotic. They are as natural as the forms that were used for hundreds and thousands of years. And so what people are saying is we need to begin to understand how to bring those icons, those symbols, into our complex world of making physical form today. So it's not just that we have the tools. The tools were invented to allow us to see and be able to replicate these formal orders. For example, if you, the study of a very primitive organism, slime mold, right? If we didn't have the computational technology, we would have just looked at slime mold and said, bleh, right? But now we know it has all sorts of characteristics that are very interesting, that have been programmed, for example, in the computer game, The Game of Life, which shows you how things aggregate, divide, multiply, seek life-sustaining conditions. So you all are living in a world that's not only fantastically more interesting, but more complex. And you cannot, I believe, overlook that complexity, because that complexity is similar to the complexity that Alberti saw at his time, faced with the fact, hey, I exist, you know, I think, therefore I am, you know, I mean, that was a very radical view of the world. Even though it seemed simple in terms of today's world, it was similar in its radical nature. And what I'm trying to do is to open up for you a history of the evolution of those things which sustain architecture in its time, and how they are modified and transformed always. And I think that, you know, the computer is dumb, but it provides you with a way of drawing that's different than the way of drawing that, for example, I had when I studied architecture. And so therefore we also have science. I mean, quantum mechanics changed Newtonian physics. Okay, now I don't pretend to understand quantum mechanics, but I do know it's had an enormous difference on the way we view the physical world. I believe that architecture has always attempted to represent these kinds of ideas in physical form, because they are the signposts of culture. They are the historical record. We can look at, for example, I always give the example of Princeton University. Princeton University has a history recorded in the tall building. The first tall building at Princeton was the chapel, which showed the importance. It was the only tall building at Princeton, showed the importance of the chapel. 40 years later, the next tall building was the library, showing you the replacing of the religious with the secular, spirit of the secular. We have a library tower. The third tall building, another 40 years on, was the administration building, which showed you what had happened to the bureaucratization of the university. The tall building was the tower. And the last tall building at Princeton was the math science building. So that if you are looking to record the evolution of Princeton as an institution, you can look to its architecture. And I think you can look to Yale, you can look to Harvard, you can look to the University of Cambridge. Any number of places have recorded in very subtle ways their evolving relationship to the town, to the institution, to their subsets, their colleges or houses, and to their professional schools. So architecture is that record. and the nature of why it's that record and how it becomes that record is what we're trying to understand. Any other questions? Yes.
Can you explain the idea of compression you're talking about in the center sphere of the ground?
Well, we're going to look at it. How about that? We'll look at it. All right? Because that's important. That's a really good question, right? And what you have to be able to do is recalibrate your eyes to understand that things that you see are not always literal. For example, when we read Shakespeare, right, and we read a line from Shakespeare, what we're reading are several things. We're reading for the sound, the onomatopoeia of the concatenation of syllables and sounds. So we have to have an ear to hear Shakespeare. But we're also reading double and triple meanings, the way words are placed in their syntax, the way they suggest other meanings other than, you know, the cat jumped over the mouse, right? Or the cat ate the mouse. That ain't Shakespeare, right? Well, architecture is equal to that. In other words, you are able to read Shakespeare. Your mind has been trained in school to understand how to read Shakespeare. What I'm going to ask you to do is I'm going to train your eyes and your mind and your hand how to read architecture, okay? And, you know, I remember the first time that I told you I went with Colin Rowe, and I had to sit in the hot sun, much hotter than this, and he'd say, tell me what is not there. Tell me what you don't see. Tell me about what you don't see. I thought, what's the guy talking about? He's a lunatic, right? And gradually I began to understand what it meant. Okay, I'm going to try and show you through pictures, but since I can't take you there, because if you were to go there and your eyes are said, hey, someone said there's a difference in the space, right? You might begin to see that. And that's what makes architecture. You can go into a lot of churches and they're nothing because they haven't got an idea about architecture. They're just literally churches. And why we remember the churches that we're looking at and the buildings that we'll look at, because not only do they function and are they literal artifacts, they structure, etc., but they have an idea about architecture. You cannot do architecture. You cannot go up in the studio and make a house that's got a bedroom and bathroom and kitchen and living room without an idea about architecture. If you don't have an idea about architecture, you're dead. Now, I would believe you could say to me, what's it mean to have an idea about architecture? You know, what the guy talking about? I mean, just put the functions down and there's architecture. Yet. Okay? So you will upstairs understand what it is to have an idea about architecture. And here, we're going to try and demonstrate how those ideas have evolved, which makes of the discipline of architecture its strategies, its tropes, its conditions of being. That doesn't mean, just because we understand from Shakespeare, that we write like Shakespeare today, okay? We write like Thomas Pynchon, who read Shakespeare, or we write like Jonathan Franzen, or we write like Ian McEwan, all right? We don't write like Shakespeare. Well, we read Shakespeare in order to be able to read Thomas Pynchon. We read Brunelleschi, Alberti, Bramante in order to be able to understand Rem Koolhaas and understand our own work in our own time. Okay? All great composers, when a person goes to study music, the music department in Princeton, they don't start drawing or writing music. They start listening to music. They have to find out what music is. And you all have to find out what architecture is. And I'm trying as best I can not to tell you there is an architecture, but there is architecture. There's a whole realm of the discipline that you need to find out about, And the way you're going to find out about it is by seeing, by drawing, by reading. Those are the only ways I know. And when it starts to become second nature, you will, you know, in a few years, you will understand, you know, maybe 10 years from now, you'll remember some of this stuff. That's why I give you the big reading list. So, we maybe better go back and look at X. Other questions? Okay, let's take a 10-minute break, and we'll come back and look at some pics. Oh, it's hot in here, man. Now we're going to do the seeing, and then we're going to do the drawing. So it will be hopefully all at some point fit together. So we have San Lorenzo, and I think the important issue to note in San Lorenzo is the relationship of the center aisle to the side aisles. In other words, there is a certain kind of this is a structure drawing, and here is the plan drawing. You have to notice that first of all, little things. You want to notice little things. There is an elongation of this, what one would call the narthex bay, between here and here, as opposed to here. Why that is that these two columns have been, from the organization of the space, compressed in, okay, to define the space. They're not here. Had they been here, this column and this column here, there would have been no articulation of a, what I would call a stopping space or a gasket space between the exterior and the processional of the nave. Okay? So what you have is something which starts off the perspectival idea of a kind of a concatenation of space, starting out by the fact that if these were here, this would be an equal concatenation. You notice the equal concatenation because these two columns are pulled off their pedestals, let's say, brought inward to articulate this idea of the thrust of this axis. So you have what I would call an A, B, 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 but it doesn't go across, and that's where we're going to see the difference between Santo Spirito, and that is, it is not a series of layers, it goes this way. And then, in other words, so what we're reading is not so much this dimension here, but we're reading the dimension from here to here. The sort of space in here is what is thematized by the movement of the columns. Then, since the center of this column is the same dimension from here to here, and because this column marks the transept crossing and the altar and is larger, the dimension between here, the literal dimension here and here, exhibits a compression. So here, because these things are articulated so that when you're here, you read the literal differences between this dimension here, which is larger, and this. And so what you have, if you're standing here, is a kind of incremental perspectival narrowing of the dimension. And here is an added literal narrowing of the dimension, so it made to seem longer. Through the compression of this bay, the axis is made to seem and extend longer. And you get an entirely different relationship of the main axis, the side aisles, and the chapels in a way that reinforces the thrust, which can be seen in the way the apse end is pushed out beyond the transept chapels, is pushed out to give that thrust, so that we not only have an axis, but we have an axis because of the perspectival organization of space that appears to the individual as having movement and a definite elongation, not only a literal elongation as you see here, but because of the actual diminution of the space, perspectively reads as farther away. Now, that's what I mean by reading a plan. You can't read it in isolation. You have to read it next to something. Next, please. And here is the articulation of the nave axis. And what you realize is that the side aisles and the side chapels are unimportant. That's because the thrust of the arches here is picked up on a wall-like structure, picked up on these columns. So that, in fact, this part of the church becomes more important than this part of the church. And the chapels are lessened because of the oculi here, which let light in from the side, which make this plane more important than the plane back here. In other words, the focus is first of all on this plane, and then on this plane, and then on the rear plane of the chapels, all of which work in the, what I would consider the Z dimension from a picture plane. That is, work in depth toward emphasizing the linearity toward the altar in this way. So while these do emphasize the circularity of these and the rondelles and oculi here, emphasize a certain symmetry in each bay, their concatenation makes it seem like the important condition is the longitudinal one. Next, please. And here you get a picture of the transept and the one of the chapels in San Lorenzo. And you have to notice, by the way, I mean, we're not stressing this in this particular lecture, but you have to notice the relationship of the column and arch here to the relationship at the transept crossing. And here you have the giant order, a secondary order, a flattened pilaster here, fluted pilaster, and a minor order. And all of these things relate proportionally, and we're going to see later how giant orders and small orders relate in a different way when we get to Palladio. But certainly when we get to Redentore and San Giorgio Maggiore, we're going to remember that this organization was available to be known to someone like Palladio. And notice the way the wall is interrupted by the transept crossing here. The articulation of the side chapel next to the transept. Next, please. What's important here is the fact how the corner we're going to look at corners because all architecture, if give me It's going?
I don't think it's going.
Yeah, it is.
It is?
Yeah.
Okay.
All architecture has, at some point or another, one wall meaning another wall. And that has great significance when it's become conscious. Here, what you have is a merely an intersection of a wall with a wall, and the sort of residue of the two columns, one here and one here, coming together to produce this intersection. Now, when we see Bramante in the Santa Maria in Rome, della Pace, Santa Maria della Pace, we're going to see a similar thing happen that's done consciously, not just two things smashing together, but smashing together in a way that's thematic. Okay? Here, two walls smash together, two corner columns, and they're just there. When, by the time of Bramante, we're going to see them articulated in a very different way. Okay, next, please. Now, this is the Pazzi Chapel by Brunelleschi. And again, we see a series of organizations which end in a corner. And Brunelleschi doesn't really know what to do with the corner. It's not a conscious phenomenon. So you get the column here, just a fragment of the column banging against this column, which takes precedent over this one. So there is no understanding thematically of the corner. They just meet where they meet, and there's no sign that that meeting is intentional. It just happens to be according to the proportions of the intercolumnation, the width of the column at the corner, etc. And here you get a sliver of a column on this side wall here. But look what happens over here. Here, again, the columns come together and you get this very thin condition where Brunelleschi does not have a consciousness of the corner, but just allows it to bang into one another. And again, when we get to Santa Maria della Pace next week, we'll see an entirely different understanding by Bramante, a consciousness that corners articulate walls, articulate ideas about walls, and can give clues to intentionality. Okay, next please. Now, clearly here, you have to notice something very different about Santa Spirita, and that is that the spatial continuity, there is a kind of space within a space. There is a kind of wrapper that wraps around the central aisle, etc., which is very different than the condition of wrapping or articulation. So it's not so much the long axis and the cruciform plan, but what you get is, first of all, a continuity here, which is very clear and articulated, but also a compression that you read from this column and this column, which is the central columnar bay, across to these. They're like flattened tires stacked up on one another. Imagine this stacked vertically. And you begin to read a layer of space here, which reads across this axis. So it's not so much this axis that's important as the crossing of this, the layering of the space, brought about by the fact that we now have, again, a picture plane. And what a picture plane allows you to do is to conceptualize depth or conceptualize what would be flatness or frontality. Okay? And so Brunelleschi realizes that what he could do with perspective in San Lorenzo, which comes first, is to exaggerate depth, literal depth, and an idea of depth brought together through perspective. And then he realizes that what a picture plane can do, which is necessary for perspective, is also to emphasize the reverse, flatness. And so he articulates in the architecture an idea of literal depth, conceptual flatness. Now what you will realize if we jump ahead to modern painting is that modern painting, cubist painting, etc., was all about taking literal depth and flattening it against the picture plane, as was when we get to Renaissance painting and Parmigianino and Bronzino. They are all about, and Pontormo, about the flattening of the figure into the picture plane. In other words, we no longer have figures in the ground, but they are flattened, as if the picture plane were a magnet and the painted figure is suddenly splat into the picture plane. So that this was a trope of painting and of architecture throughout much of the history of architecture and painting. And what painting, that is, painting after cubism, post-war painting, attempted to do was to do away with the picture plane. In other words, the convention of the picture plane, which had become naturalized in painting, to try and do away with it, so there was no longer a mediating device between the canvas in its being and the human subject. And what you get then is the saturation, the kind of treatment of the canvas as not just a surface of a representation, but a literal surface of being. And we get action painting, painting that's scraped on with trowels and knives and whatever. We get canvases that are punched. All kinds of things happen that deny the conceptual nature of the vertical surface. And what we're getting in architecture today is also a denial of the conceptual nature when we get to something which I would call a metabolic surface, where the surface is active and alive as an organism rather than as a picture plane. So all of these things have their origin in a history that begins with the consciousness of the subject in Brunelleschi. Okay, can we have the next, please? The comparison between the plans of San Lorenzo and Santo Spirito. Can I have the next, please? And we see the difference here with San Lorenzo is on the left, the main aisle, and Santo Spirito is on the right. And the difference in the plane, this plane, notice the fact that the wall here emphasizes the linearity here, whereas the half-round chapel articulation, continued articulation chapel, suggests a different ordering of space. Next, please. And of course, these drawings and pictures don't necessarily give you, you really have to go there with these drawings in mind and the ideas in mind to be able to experience them. Okay, these are the sections of San Lorenzo, and next please. And the sections of Santo Spirito. No, these are also, sorry, they're also San Lorenzo. Next please. And here we have San Lorenzo on the left. This is perhaps the best way of understanding. There's San Lorenzo and there's Santo Spirito. And this plane here is missing, right? And the plane up here with the oculi are missing. Instead, we have this depth, this half-round, half-molded depth of all of these chapels that create a horizontal articulation, a compressive cross-axial articulation about the main axis. And you just have to be able to look very carefully at these two slides to understand clearly the difference in the project. It's important, you know, we could study, you know, in detail the capital structure here versus here. Basically all are Gothic structure, so the structure is unimportant. It's got to be this plane, these oculi here, as opposed to the light coming from the farthest reach of the chapel, as opposed to this plane over here. Those are the things, those differences we're trying to articulate as intentional strategies. Okay, next please. And the side aisles of Santo Spirito, and again, here is the section of this half-round arching of the lateral chapels that give you, in space when you're in the central axis, this idea. Next, please. And a axonometric view from a kind of worm's eyes view of the spatial organization of Santo Spirito, and the modular plan, how this works. And what you notice is that unlike San Lorenzo, the dimension from here to here in when you enter is the same as the dimension from here to here. And what he's done, which is really interesting, is to move these columns off of this dimension so that the pure dimension of the continuity of the dimension is continued. It's drawn differently over here, but if you notice over here, this continuity is uninterrupted by the nave crossing columns. It's something you see. And also, one of the most important things is in this need to continue this movement around. Look what he does here at the corner. This is quite stunning. Look at these corner projections to continue the intersection to produce both a half round here and a half round here. You get a very interesting, what is called poche. That is the dimension of solid that is not necessarily structural, but conceptual. That is, to carry the idea of continuity is carried in the solid. So this is called poche, and we're going to see when we get to Bramante how poche becomes a very important issue in the articulation of the work. What I want to do now is, we've got an hour. We're going to go next door. We're going to look at the drawings. There are five drawings that are not lettered, no names.
They don't have names on.
Yeah, there are five drawings with no names, and we need to get all the names on the drawings. So we'll reconvene shortly.
There's something to be said.
So you've got next week's.
We're not going upstairs. Is there a men's room? There is one.
Right
out there.
Yeah.
Here, take that. This is.